Thanks, Andrew, and a very warm welcome to everyone tonight to this wonderful space, to this event, which is part of, as you all know, the wonderful series of events put on by the London Review of Books Bookshop to remind us of the centrality and the importance of reading and talking about reading and writing, the central place that holds in our cultural lives. It gives us the opportunity to meet and hear great writers reading from their work and talking about their work, for us to be in conversation with those writers, and for us to all participate in the discussion. And I'm hoping as the evening goes on, as Jane and I talk, that you'll all feel free to join in and contribute and ask questions. Rather than saving the questions for the end, let's make this a kind of discussion that can flow throughout. It's a very, very great pleasure and privilege and indeed honour to be introducing Jane Anne Phillips this evening in London. I first came upon her work many years ago when I was a student and an American friend of mine put a copy of Black Tickets into my hands. I sat down and read these stories in one sitting and was immediately swept away by the scope and the originality of the project. I felt I hadn't read stories like this ever before in my life. And these were stories that, yes, reached back and reminded me of the modernist project of Virginia Woolf, that talked, seemed to describe their own making as I was reading them. But there were also stories that were like Virginia Woolf on acid. You know, these were stories that were stinging with color and sensation, that were vividly alive. I couldn't stop thinking about them. A writer I was reading recently talks about Jane Anne Phillips' work kind of being injected straight into your bloodstream. And indeed, that's how it felt. And in her subject matter, too, I was seeing something new. Here were characters who were drifters and outsiders, prostitutes, drug addicts, pimps. She was making these people the subject of literature, but she was also, and again returning to my Virginia Woolf thing, capturing these moments of being. Tiny moments lived in people's lives, marginalized lives, seen perhaps out of the corner of one's eye, these became the subject for her stories. And from these stories, other stories grew. The same lovely, generous American friend then gave me her earlier work, the prose poems, Sweethearts and Counting. And this showed that Jane Anne was someone absolutely engaged in her own unique project, because this is work made up, she's described it herself, sentence by sentence writing. Because she's a poet, every sentence has that kind of attention. And what I was seeing was a world apprehended through the senses, everything made sensually and vividly alive and present on the page. So yes, this work, unlike anything else I'd read before, and I want to perhaps to talk later on, when we're getting into discussion about her beautiful new book, Lark and Termite, about the extent to which she holds up this difference, this beautiful singing originality. Because to my mind, there's no one else that she can be compared to. And there's been a lot of talk in the press about books that we can compare Lark and Termite to. No, I think that this is a book that sits alone. But I'd love to hear what all you think about that and for that to be part of our conversation later. But yes, I'm not alone in saying that. Raymond Carver, when Black Tickets came out, said these are stories unlike any other in our literature. Nadine Gordimer said of the same, this is the finest short story writer since Eudora Welty. Jane Anne Phillips was born and brought up in West Virginia, and there's a feeling that that landscape and the inhabitants of that landscape, the places they drift to from that landscape, are the kind of underpainting of all her fiction. There's a sense of those colours and that kind of emotional, that emotional texture leaches through all of the work. Black Tickets, as I said, was her first collection of stories, published in 1979, immediately won the prestigious Sue Kaufman Award, awarded by the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. After that followed her novel, first novel, Machine Dreams, in 1984, which was a New York Times bestseller and was one of the 12 top books from the New York Times list that year. Fast Lanes in 1987, another collection of poetry described by one critic as stories that hover on the edge of poetry. And again, that relationship between her particular kind of fiction and her work as a poet is something I'd love to explore and talk about tonight. Then followed Shelter in 1994, again awarded a prestigious Academy Award in Literature from the Academy of Arts and the Academy of Arts and Letters. Then Motherkind in 2000, a ravishing fictional meditation upon the centrality of maternity in life and returning us, I think, importantly to that subject in a way that made it central to literature in a way that I don't think we've seen since fairy tale or since myth, fable. And now we have the beautiful Lark and Termite just published this month and that we'll be hearing Jane Eyre read from and talk about tonight. Jane Eyre's work has been translated into 12 languages. She's a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and two National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. She's been published in a range of prestigious magazines and publications around the world, including Granter and Harper's. Her work is included in the Norton Contemporary Anthology of American Literature. She's taught at Harvard and a number of academies and universities throughout America and is currently Professor of Literature and Writing at the University of Rutgers. Can we give a very warm welcome to our guest this evening? We've been talking about how the evening's going to be, and we're going to, Jane Eyre and I are going to chat for a bit. She's going to read, we'll talk, have some questions, you'll read again. Can I start off by asking you where this book came from?
I would want to just thank all of you for coming and say that it's wonderful, this format, because I feel as though Kirsty is doing all the work.
I'm stopping right now.
No, what was the question?
Where did this book come from?
I don't think the writer ever really knows where the book comes from. I feel as though all the work is a continuum and that one book isn't written without the others having preceded it. But this book was a bit different in that there was an actual physical image that I think began it for me. Maybe 30 years ago, I was visiting a high school friend in my hometown, Buchanan, West Virginia, which is a town of about 6,000 or 7,000 people in north central West Virginia, kind of between Clarksburg and Weston and Elkins, if you know the area. And she'd rented a little apartment on the second floor of a garage, that is a garage behind a house, and we were standing looking out her window, and her window overlooked a kind of grass alley between these houses, and there were six or seven small tin-roofed houses that fronted on the alleys that were the main street. And there was a little sort of 1950s lawn chair set up in front of one of these houses, and a child was sitting there with his legs folded up under him, facing the empty alley, holding to his forehead a strip of long blue dry cleaner bag, a blue piece of plastic, and he was blowing on it so that it was constantly moving in front of his face. And I said to my friend, "Who is that and what is he doing?" And she said, "I don't know, but he sits that way for hours." And the image just sort of stayed with me. And I didn't at all think about a novel at that point. But several years later, I was living in Cambridge, Mass, and a friend of mine, her boyfriend and I happened to share a birthday. Birthdays figure heavily in Lark and Termite. And I was looking through her sketchbook, and I saw this drawing, and I admired it, and she ripped it out and gave it to me. And she had actually written around the top some very scribbled words, and the first word was termite, something, 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 something. And the picture immediately reminded me of that boy. It's sort of abstract. He seems to be turning to the side, holding something up as though he's blowing on it. And so his name became Termite for me. And I guess I sort of had in mind a very fuzzy idea of a book in which he would not really be heard from, but the book would move around him. And then many other things happened. I mean, I really think this book has been in gestation for, 20 years or so. I actually began it before I began Motherkind, and then decided to finish Motherkind, and then went back to this book. So it's really been through a lot of changes, and more than probably any other book I've done it, there have been a lot of just kismet moments, moments of coincidence, and yes, the book is full of secrets that eventually unfold, and that was not according to a plan. I didn't construct a plan in which A would become B. It just happened inside the material, because I hope and I think that material should dictate form, and the material teaches me how to enter it, what to do with it, just as I hope and I think a good book teaches the reader how to read it. You sort of enter the book, and within a few pages, you're reading the book as the book intends itself to be read. Mm. And you're bringing something very specific to it, because your unconscious and your subconscious and your thinking mind, too, are all engaged in ways that you might be aware of or might not be conscious of.
I think your work gives us that instruction particularly clearly, simply because of the beauty and particularity of how it delivers itself sentence by sentence. So we start to read almost as though it were aloud in our own minds, and in that act of reading it becomes a kind of incantatory experience, and then we enter into the world fully. Would you read a section for us now?
Oh, sure. I'll read the beginning, or actually the end of Corporal Robert Levitt's first section of the book. This is really, for those of you who haven't read it, it's a book about parallel worlds. One part of the book takes place in July of 1950 in South Korea, as Corporal Robert Levitt is trying to evacuate a series of small villages in the wake of the North Korean advance. And he's very much aware that his child is about to be born in the U.S. The second part, or the second world in the book, takes place exactly 9 years later in the same July days, picking up the world of the child who, in fact, was born that day. His older sister, Lark, his 17-year-old half-sister, Lark, and his maternal aunt, Noni, who's raised both children, both of them having been given up by Lola, their mother. So I'm going to stand up because I think people should read standing up. Corporal Robert Levitt, July 26, 1950, Chuncheong Province, South Korea. All month he's carried a snapshot of Lola in the breast pocket of his stinking fatigues, wrapped in a cellophane-encased cigarette pack against the rain. Lola in the hammock they'd strung on the third floor porch off her room. Even in black and white, her dark red hair looks red, and her eyes look blue, the pretty lines at the corners a little deeper. She rests one hand on her rounded belly, her smile languid and sweet, like she's about to pour him a glass of that minted tea she spikes with a little rum. This morning when the platoon hurriedly pulled out, the new replacements stumbling and nervous, Levitt missed the carefully flattened cigarette pack and Lola's picture. Losing it was bad luck. On the back, she'd written, 7 months along. He will be hearing any day. He's glad about the baby. He's put his mark on her, held his territory until he can get back and claim her. He thinks about her with other men in a past before he knew her, and blocks images out of his mind. Lola has a past and a kid, a daughter who lives with her older sister in West Virginia. The sister manages a restaurant, pays a mortgage on her own house. Noreen was the strong one, Lola said, and nobody's fool. It was better. Levitt imagines an ultra-respectable schoolmarm type, kindly enough to raise Lola's daughter while she disapproves of singers and bars and military towns. Lola wouldn't say her daughter's name, even to him. I gave her a bird's name. Maybe she'll grow up safe and fly away. Rural hamlets here are derivations of one another, dirt track villages of shabby wooden buildings. Levitt has scribbled the similar romanized names of the villages emptied today in his dirty, palm-sized notebook. Chugok Ri, No Gun Ri, MK Ri. No plumbing, no electricity. What did the refugees carry in those bundles on their backs and heads? What did they gather up when the soldiers appeared, rousting them out before the North Koreans swept through? Intelligence warned some carried ordnance and mortars to North Korean units. If they did, Levitt thought, they were North Korean infiltrators. Remaining ROK units couldn't be trusted with the few North Korean prisoners they'd taken. They shot them outright. Still, both sides took advantage of the American inability to tell them apart unless they were uniformed. Levitt takes off his helmet, wipes the sweat from his face. Ikujuro, he calls to the Koreans. This way. The double railroad overpass is closer now. Levitt can see that the tunnels below are slightly curved and relatively deep. He can't see through them. The dirt road moves through one into dark shade and the stream through the other. They're stone or concrete, bunker-like, arched, like two deep eyes, angled slightly askance. He'll keep the Koreans on the tracks, then direct them down the grassy incline to rest in the shade of the tunnels. He'll tell the refugees to proceed south on their own. Circle his men back to regroup. Reduce chances the platoon will be stranded or cut off. Don't watch Aseo. A girl stands full in front of Levitt, blocking his path, burdened by the nearly grown child on her back. She fills his vision, shocking and sudden. Don't watch Aseo, she says again. Help me. It's a demand, not a request. For a moment he wonders if he knows her, one of the girls from Seoul. But no, this one's a village girl, beautiful, petite like most of them, dressed in the usual white garments, a purely rural girl who has never been to Seoul. She seems as furious as Levitt feels, as they should all feel, walking away like this, losing everything. Frantically, she gestures toward the tracks. Halmoni, she says, Halmoni. Not her mother. It's the word for grandmother or great aunt. The girl runs back to stand over her, looks at Levitt, pleads with him angrily as though it's his job to help only her. This girl has never left her village. She's forgotten nothing and is fiercely herself. She's the child's guardian, the old woman's protector, and she stands, legs outspread, planted to provide the old woman a barrier. The crowd in white, all of them, these farmers wear white, parts around her, barely disturbed, moving on. She glares at Levitt, enraged that she needs help, angry at herself. She can't carry the boy on her back and pick up the old woman, yet she won't put the boy down, not here, even for a moment. Monitor, do not assist. Those are his orders, repeated to his men just hours ago as this venture started. Levitt's whistle rends the air, signaling the platoon to tighten along the refugee column. Keep everyone moving. Levitt looks at the old woman, the girl. She stands unbending, staring at him, waiting, holding the child. The boy tilts his head oddly, too old to be carried. He's crippled, slow-witted, something. Levitt nods at the girl, yes, and dread breaks over him. Something imminent approaches, something to hurt them all, carry them away. Is it her? Someone in the crowd? Unlikely an infiltrator would attack here unless the crowd was full of them. The girl looks at Levitt, willing him closer. Her eyes burn into him, her perfectly oval face nearly opalescent. She could be the kid's mother or his sister. Who could tell? The women here all look so young until they're suddenly ancient. Levitt steps back to sight his men, then wades quickly into the crowd. As though on signal, the girl reaches out, shifts the burden of the child to him, and bends over the old woman. Stronger than she looks, she lifts the old lady to her feet and half supports her, moving on as though Levitt will simply follow. He nearly does, but reaches out to touch her shoulder. Kujikuro, he shouts, to the side, move to the side, out of the flow of the crowd. The kid's legs circle Levitt's waist. He shifts his rifle to one shoulder and clasps the boy to his hip. Bikyo, he says calmly, out. The girl needs no further direction. She stays close and follows Levitt, urging the old woman along. The boy weighs nothing. He must be 8, 9. The grip of his thin arms is firm, the aspect of his upper body wholly tense. He moves his head, listening, the curved shell of his ear turned up. Their faces are inches apart. Levitt sees into the boy's stunning, nearly reflective eyes. The obsidian irises float a pale blue milk, and his pupils are invisible behind blue splashes of cataract. He's blind, That's why the girl wouldn't put him down. The cloudiness in his eyes seems to subtly pulse or dilate. The boy looks with complete attention, seems to see past Levitt or into him. He's not slow or not exactly. He seems preternaturally alert. Levitt has difficulty looking away, but averts his eyes and quickens his pace through the crowd. He feels the girl's hand on his lower back and slows just enough to accommodate her progress with the old woman. "Follow me," he calls to her in Korean. "Stay with me." Moving quickly, edging through, he feels the boy's small body go rigid, his apprehension heightened to a nearly audible pitch. Levitt imagines the clear high tone of a tuning fork struck in midair. It's that kind of focus, emotionless and pure, so sharply true that nothing else exists. Suddenly he understands, and he hears what the boy hears. Planes, thrumming overhead, closing fast. There's no way out. The refugees move doggedly forward. Perfectly exposed, they're a white column seemingly moving in formation, and the strafing begins. Thanks.
That was so lovely. And introduces me to a question that I've had throughout the reading of this book, and a question that indeed plays over all of your work, the kind of what I might call transcriptive nature of your prose, the way you pick up. I love what you said earlier when you talked about your content delivers you into a form, the way in which one image will play out in a reflection of another. So what we have here in that dense description of the tunnel and this threatening so-called friendly fire that's going to take place outside that will threaten the lives of all those within the tunnel, we have this image of the adult with the frail, damaged child in the arms of the adult, which is an image that, of course, then plays out later when we come to meet Termite and his relationship with the adults around him. When you talked about the book beginning with that image of the child with the blue pieces of plastic, how long did it take you to realize that there was this other story, this other tunnel, as it were, within the fiction?
That was a kind of interesting story in that Lark's voice was the first voice in this book. I think those questions that I ask when I saw this child, who is that and what is he doing, are the questions I was answering in the novel. And then in a sense, when I saw him, I became Lark to a degree. That is, I became this person who was thinking about this image. And her first words seemed to take off right from that chair, because the first words of the novel for me were, "I move his chair into the yard under the tree, and then Noni carries him out." And her voice sort of described things she doesn't know and the things she knows, the town, what she thinks about Termite, the secret of their mother, the fact that she doesn't know who her father is. And she says, Termite's father was killed early in the Korean War, but we never got his body back, and they had to have the service around a flag that was folded up. Mm-hmm. Noni says it's wrong and it will never be right. It was wrong and it will never be right. Now, that's a phrase that my mother used to use. About what, I no longer remember. So I had thought about the book being situated in 1959, partly because it was such an image from the 50s, this alley, this very green alley behind these houses. And also because I didn't want Termite to be too labeled. I didn't want terms applied to him. I wanted it to be a world in which he simply would exist as he is, and his family would take care of him. And it was Lark who said his father was killed in Korea, which of course would have been the war just 9 years previous. And I began to realize that he was born as his father was dying. And Lark describes very specifically the things Termite is, things he fixates on, the sort of sensory overload that sort of puts him into an almost fugue-like state of, that could be ecstasy or simply fixation. But he loves the sound of storms and rain, and he loves the sound of the train and going to the train yard and being actually pulled beside the train as it's moving off. And he loves this double tunnel that's beside the river. And West Virginia is full of these sort of chiseled stone structures, bridges, tunnels, many of which were built during the WPA, during the Depression, by the Works Project Administration, something that Obama should definitely reinvigorate. So I had in mind very specifically these shapes, and Termite is always thinking about things in terms of shapes. And I was working on the book, and then in 1999, September 30th, 1999, a team of AP reporters broke the story of No Gun Ree, and there was a large color photograph on the cover of the New York Times of a Korean woman dressed in pink, gesticulating angrily, and behind her you saw from afar these tunnels, this very specific double shape. You could see the depth and this and the arches of the tunnels. And I looked at the image and knew that was what had happened to Termite's father, and that enormously complicated the novel, because it was no longer the story of this boy, it was also the story of that world that preceded him, and these counterparts, and all these counterpart images, some of which I was conscious of, and some of which were simply very surprising later on in the book.
But in a way, what you're describing then in the making of it is a kind of process of recognition or recovery. And we were talking earlier because, you know, we were talking earlier about Virginia Woolf never called any of her novels novels. She called them elegies. And we were talking about the elegiac nature of your work and this sense of recovery to make a world good. In this case, we've got a damaged child, and you're kind of gifting him to us as something whole and beautiful and worthy of our attention and gaze. You're bringing back something that's lost and making it live again. When we talk about the image of the two tunnels and that notion of recognition, for those of you who haven't yet read the book is divided into three main sections where photographs are used at the beginning of a double tunnel. And for a while, as I was reading, I thought these were the tunnels in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And then, as I read in, realized that they were also, they were this other tunnel. And then that tunnel started inviting me to make these kinds of links that I was talking about earlier, for us to see aspects of the novel here that was also played out there. Can I ask you the extent to which you make your work, whether it's a novel or a collection of short stories, the extent to which, to use that phrase of Raymond Carver's, you're spending all of your imaginative material on the section in hand. So, for example, with the Levitt section here in the tunnel, that you're spending all of that to make it a story in its own right that will then be slotted, that piece of the tunnel, as it were, slotted into the fiction as the whole thing develops?
It's not really slotted. It's more a sense that when you look through a kaleidoscope and you see these movement of shapes, that no matter how you turn the whatever it's called lens, the shapes connect in a different way and they move in and out of one another, and it's very alive, and it's that sense of metaphor. And I like the word recognition. There is definitely a recognition, recognizing the material, but there's also a kind of an arc that one follows, and there is definitely this idea of presenting real life back to people, and that the idea of Termite and the way that he thinks and the way that language is sort of refracted, made of language and yet turned away from language into sound itself. The idea that it's not only a recognition, but it's a privilege. Privilege to gain access to the world that we really live in, the world of history, the world of the mind, the world of sensory awareness, all of which are connected, and the miraculousness of it, even with the darkness that's constantly around it. I mean, when, in the Levitt section, that image of night soil, which was a very real element in Korea, and something that was very alien to the Westerners there. This sense of this fetid earth that was fetid because it was so fertile. This sort of natural yin-yang of death inside life. And the fact that this war is taking place, and Levitt's consciousness, I mean, he's a bit more conscious of Korean culture than the typical American soldier, because he's been in the country for a few months, and he has, as you learn, as these sections move forward, this culture almost comes up as a kind of contrast to the culture that he comes from, and yet he does recognize it.
Yes.
As I think anyone does reading, I mean, I think we recognize in other cultures a kind of amalgamation of our own symbols and stories.
There's also that thing that Edward Said talks about when he talks about, and Chekhov too, that the more specific you are in talking about a culture or a nation, the more universal you become.
Exactly.
And there's a real sense, we were talking about a piece that was written about the book in the LA Times, and the writer talks about Jane Anne's use of image to create this kind of particularity, that so many writers use metaphor. Now, metaphor means that the writer's very much sitting up, you know, on his or her chair above the audience, describing a kind of an imaginative project that begins as something quite private and then is disclosed through the reading. Whereas with Jane Anne Phillips' work, we get these images that compel us towards them, and then the images become more and more particular, and we claim them as our own. Going back to Levitt in the tunnel, and your use of the darkness of life, the darkness of death, and yet the vividness of life, what's so beautiful about those sections too is that even as he's clearly dying, his whole life is kind of lit up by memory as he kind of, you know, dives down and relives sections and relives his great love affair with Lola and contemplates the child who will be born, imagines him being born, and so on. There's a kind of rebirthing that happens in that tunnel as well.
Yeah, I mean, I want the reader not to watch the characters, but to be the characters, to become the characters inside the language. And
that's the most exciting idea I've heard for a long time. The idea that language can carry us right into the center of the imaginative experience is extremely exciting. When you talked about, you had this idea that you heard Lark's voice, and that was your first line. I'm always quoting to my students something that you said a long time ago, that you wait for this line, and then, if you know, on a good day, pull up the rest of the story, kind of follows the sense of inevitability that comes from the language.
I think if you are a language-oriented writer, you take your cues from the line itself. When people say to me, how do you know what to write next? I say, I don't know what to write next. I read the line until I know what comes next. Mm. And for me, that's the way a book is built. It's a very long, ridiculous process. It has no guarantees, it has no plan. But I really feel as though having a plan would simply limit what could happen in the book. I mean, I sort of midway through, I sometimes write a list, sort of grocery list kind of idea of what's here and what's coming. But it's merely, you know, it certainly isn't an outline. Maybe there was something about outlining things and diagramming sentences that I just had a very bad reaction to as a child, because I didn't want to know what the parts of the sentence were called, and I didn't want to put them on a frame and take them apart. I very much learned to write by reading and having a particular feel being really overwhelmed by language in much the same way that the termite is overwhelmed by sensation, by really entering language. And I think language holds that up to us, holds it up to anyone. And there are certain writers who really help readers enter that process.
Yes.
In a very specific way that's known only to them.
So you're suggesting that language takes us on a journey in a way that something like an outline or a plan would limit. And I think a lot of us probably in this room feel the frustrations and the deep limitations of so many books whereby that plan is felt to be so obvious from the beginning and that dictates our reading and then creates this kind of ghastly instructive didactic process, as opposed to this organic kind of journey where we tunnel in and bury into the language and become the language itself?
Well, it depends what you want. I mean, some people love plans and formulas because they're comforting. That's why people love Law and Order. You know, there are so many pieces of Law and Order, so many different spin-offs, because it's all, there's the thing, it's presented, it's solved. But literature, I think, is not, it's never a formula. It really is a living exploration, and it really does not end with the last page. There should be a sort of, you know, like the stone thrown into the pond. It should continue to kind of reverberate, and it should appear differently if one enters, you know, this world 10 years from now. It should present itself in a really, in a different way.
I think it's got a lot to do with, you know, this thing of wanting to be in control. And I'm always taken by, you know, the kind of general reviewing that we see in most of our broadsheets here, and indeed in America, where there's a constant kind of rehashing of the plot. You know, you're constantly being told the plot over and over and over again. And the book is actually described at the end of the day in terms of whether the plot is good and whether it's like life. Whereas your books give up a rich interior life. They make it possible, as you said, to enter into this world, to be the characters, to live their lives without any of this endless, you know, he thought, she thought. I mean, endless amounts of he thought, she thought are not going to necessarily give us that interior world. And yet, so many books are structured that way, and so many novels are talked about in those kinds of terms. We were talking earlier about that notion of mystery and uncertainty. Can I just be a real kind of old teaching bore and read this gorgeous little bit from Flannery O'Connor, which I think describes Jane Eyre's work terrifically well. Hawthorne knew his own problems and perhaps anticipated ours when he said he did not write novels, he wrote romances. Today, many readers and critics have set up for the novel a kind of orthodoxy. They demand a realism of fact which may, in the end, limit rather than broaden the novel's scope. We've become so flooded with sorry fiction based on unearned liberties or on the notion that fiction must represent the typical that in the public mind, the deeper kinds of realism are less and less understandable. Yeah, it's so beautiful. And to your work describes that deeper kind of realism. I mean, it's not like a world that any of us may have experienced. It is the world as you describe it. When I think about my experience of reading your books, going back to Sweethearts and Counting and Black Tickets, what I see is that you are mining this world over and over and bringing out new richness from it, showing us new things. I can see reflections in Termite of a character in a story in Fast Lanes, which was written so many years before, that story Bessie with the child who's wrapped up in bandages and is also vulnerable. I can see all kinds of characters and nuances that seem to reflect through your work. To what extent are you aware of that when you enter a new project?
I don't need to be aware of it. I mean, I tell my students, all stories have been told. All the stories have been told. There are only so many stories. Each of our individual lives, everything that happens to us has happened to everyone else. But it's intense and important because our consciousness is experiencing it. So it's not a, it's never about the story. It's interesting. I've never been, I've said in the past, I'm not that interested in the plot and what happens now and now and now, because I think in fact things move in a kind of spiral from an inner core outward, and we're all somewhere kind of on that spectrum. The story really is just about getting to the core of meaning, that there is a meaning. You know, I mean, there is, has always been this, you know, is it just random? Is it all just a kind of random confluence of events? Or is there a meaning? And you could say that literature discovers meaning or creates meaning, and maybe it doesn't really matter which it is, because then people on both sides of the divide can agree. Mm. It's created or it's discovered. The point is, there is meaning, and that's a statement of faith. And it has to do with, I think about the word redemption, because I think that we are redeeming the meaningfulness of life, not only life for human beings, but sentient life.
Mm.
There is this sense of everything being alive. And to recognize that is so encouraging.
Becomes an act of celebration to read. Let us hear another section.
Oh, well, that's a little... I mean, I think it. There's no one who has a more a less optimistic view, my husband would say, than me. Well, I'll read another section. This is the beginning of Lark's first section of the book, and was the beginning of the book for me, and I'll just read a little bit in her voice. Winfield, West Virginia, July 26, 1959. Lark. I move his chair into the yard under the tree, and then Noni carries him out. The tree's getting all full of seeds, and the pods hang down. Soon enough, the seeds will fly through the air, and Noni will have hay fever and want all the windows shut to keep the white puffs out. Termite will want to be outside in the chair all the time then, and he'll go on and on at me if I try to keep him indoors so I can do the ironing or clean up the dishes. Sun or rain, he wants to be out, early mornings especially. Okay, you're out, Noni will say, and he starts his sounds, quiet and satisfied, before she even puts him down. She has on her white uniform to go to work at Charlie's, and she holds Termite out from her a ways, not to get her stockings run with his long toenails, or her skirt stained with his fingers, because he always has jam on them after breakfast. There's Termite. Noni puts him in the chair with his legs under him, like he always sits. Anybody else's legs would go to sleep all day like that. You keep an eye on him, Lark, Noni says. Noni straightens Termite. Get him one of those cleaner bag ribbons from inside. I've got to go. Charlie will have my ass. A car horn blares in the alley. Termite blares too then, trying to sound like the horn. Elise is here, Noni says. Don't forget to wash the dishes and wipe off his hands. She's already walking off across the grass, but Termite is outside, so he doesn't mind her going. Termite, I say to him, and he says it back to me. He always gets the notes right without saying the words. His sounds are like a one-tone song, and the day is still and flat. It's 7 in the morning, and here and there a little bit of air moves in pieces like a tease, like things are getting full, so slow no one notices. Termite, I tell him. I'll fix the radio, don't worry. He's got to have something to listen to. He moves his fingers the way he does, with his hands up and all his fingers pointing, then curving, each in a separate motion, fast or careful. He never looks at his fingers, but I always think he hears or knows something through them, like he does it for some reason. Charlie says he's just spastic. That's a spastic motion. Noni says he's fidgety with whatever he has that he can't put to anything. His fingers never stop moving unless we give him something to hold. Then he holds on so tight we have to pry whatever it is away from him. Noni says that's just cussedness. I think when he holds something, his fingers rest. He doesn't always want to keep hearing things. I tell Termite, it's not going to rain yet. It's going to be hot and white. Then really late, we might have that big storm they talk about. Big storm they talk about, Termite says back to me in sounds like my words. That's right, I tell him, but you have to watch for him in the window. Don't think you're going to sit out here in the rain with lightning flashing all around you. He doesn't say anything to that. He might be thinking how great it would be. Wind and rain, real hard rain, not like the summer rain we let him sit out in sometimes. He likes motion. He likes things on his skin. He's alive all over that way. Noni says I put thoughts in his head. He might not be thinking anything. Maybe he doesn't have to think, I tell her. Just don't you be thinking a lot of things about him that aren't true, she'll say. But no one can tell what's true about him. I remember when Termite came. Noni's his guardian and his aunt, but I'm his sister. In a way, he's more mine than anyone else's. He'll be mine for longer, is what Noni says. Noni isn't old, but she always talks to me about when she'll be gone. She looks so strong, like a block or a rectangle, strong in her shoulders and back and her wide hips. Your mother didn't bring him, is what Noni told me. Someone brought him for her, not his father. Noni says Termite's father was only married to my mother for a year. He was a baby, Noni says, 21 when my mother was nearly 30, and those bastards left him over there in Korea. No one even got his body back. They had to have the service around a flag that was folded up. Noni says it was wrong and it will never be right. But I don't know how Termite got here because Noni sent me away that week to church camp. She never got a birth certificate, though. We count the day he came, his birthday. But I make him a birthday whenever it suits me. Today could be a birthday, I tell him. You come inside with me while I mix the cake. You can hold the radio and turn the dials around, okay? Dials around, okay. I can almost answer for him, but I don't, and he doesn't. He doesn't want to come inside. I can feel him holding still. He wants to sit here. He puts his hand up to his face, to his forehead, as though he's holding one of those strips of blue plastic Noni calls ribbons. That's what he wants. There's no wind, Termite, I tell him, but he blows with his lips, short sighs. I move his chair back from the alley and I go inside and get the ribbon. It's too small to get tangled, and anyway, we watch him. I take it out to him and wrap it around his hand, and he holds it with his fingers curled up to his forehead. I'll get dressed and clean up the kitchen, I tell him. But when I make the cake, you're going to have to come inside, okay? He casts his eyes sideways at me. That means he agrees, but he's thinking about the blue, that strip of space he can move. Termite, I tell him, I'm going back in. Back in, back in, back in. I hear him as I walk away. Now he'll be silent as a breather, quiet as long as I let him be. I stand at the kitchen sink where I can see him and run the water, hot as it can get. I watch Termite. I can see him blowing on the ribbon. He likes the blue of the plastic and he likes to see through it. He blows it out from his face and watches it move. It barely touches him. He blows it away. He'll do that for 30 minutes, for an hour. Till you take it away from him. I'm so used to being with Termite, he feels like alone to me. He's like a hum that always hums, so the edge of where I am is blunt and softened. When I push the dishes under, I don't look at them. I keep my eyes on him out the window. He moves that clear blue ribbon with his breath, ripples it slow in front of his eyes, sees through blue if he sees or just feels it touching him and flying out. I can hear the air at his open lips. I hear the air conditioner down at the restaurant, too. Noni is taking orders in the breakfast rush. It's already crowded and hot. Tables and stools at the counter filled, and the big box over the door is grinding its firm noise. Charlie calls it the system. Later in the afternoon, most everyone is cleared out, and Noni's getting ready to come home. The system will be catching and pulling like it can't quite breathe, saying sip, 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 all wounded. Noni leaves while it's sighing when they're setting up for dinner. Charlie wanted me to take the dinner shift after I graduated, but Noni said I wasn't graduating high school to be a 17-year-old waitress. She says I don't need a job. Termite's my job, and Barker secretarial when she can be home nights to stay with Termite. The point is to make things better, Noni says. Have a future. I'm looking at Termite in the alley past his chair. And it's funny how that piece of see-through blue he holds to his face looks how I think a future would, waving like that, moving start to finish, leading off into space.
is so attentive to the ordinary, you know, the minutiae of detail, and her business is with the present. Noni has a story to tell that's about the past.
Mm.
But with both characters, you use the first person in a very deliberate way that's not, in many respects, trying to be entirely naturalistic, that involves all the details of storytelling. There's very much the sense that these are characters who have a story to tell. I have something to tell you about, is how we feel. We feel privileged to be part of this story that's being unfurled. So you have your two women as first-person storytellers, and you have your two men, Termite the boy and Levitt, being relayed in the third person. What gave you, what's that all about?
Well, it was just a necessity, because I had to create or suggest the world that was happening on the battlefield to him in an immediate sense, and yet telescope his entire life into the reader's mind, and sort of sustain the movement through what is actually happening as we are getting deeper and deeper into who Levitt is and what he's thinking about. I mean, I think we're all very aware that when, you know, that our senses sort of are connected in a kind of spider web, and so easily kind of broken off and broken through. But if we lose one sense, we begin to compensate in some way, even in the way our bodies grow.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have scoliosis, you know, and in scoliosis, one hip grows higher than the other to compensate. It's such a natural kind of occurrence. It happens in nature all the time, and some of the most interesting or ghastly things happen as a result of this compensation. But as Levitt becomes more and more injured, closer and closer to death, his body begins to shut down, but his senses almost open up. I mean, part of it is a kind of fever dream. Kind of drifting in space. It often happens when people are moving in and out of consciousness. I mean, it's something we're very aware of, I think. But it's almost as though this realm of the senses is always there. We simply don't always attend to it because we are so physically involved in the present, mm-hmm. in actually moving through space and doing what we're doing and talking to whom we're talking to and taking care of our list of things that we're engaged in. But this much larger world is always there. And
well, I think you enmesh that reading of experience, either of being told as a very deliberate story by the two women, or this sense of free and direct narrative playing up the kind of vivid minute-by-minute experience. I wonder, I'd love to ask you all in the audience, what you feel your reading experience is, how it differs when you're reading first person versus third person account, whether you go in with expectations that are met or whether both experiences feel like the same, and whether in a book like Jane Eyre's, where you've got both voices working, how that makes you react to the text, if you kind of find yourself falling into it in different ways. I'm always interested in that kind of first person, third person divide.
Well, I think Termite, Levitt had to be third person because of the demands of what had to be established. And Termite, it had to be a third person voice because he simply doesn't speak. He would never think in the eye. And that those sections had to try to approximate his perceptions, which are very much based on sound and not image, really, but shape. And the reader is very much pulled into the secrets inside the book, because the reader actually recognizes what's happening between the characters in ways that they themselves don't and can't.
Yeah.
Because the reader has been inside Levitt's recollections in Leavitt's life, and the reader has been inside what Termite sees and doesn't see. And it's very clear that his physical vision is very blurry and moves. He can see only if something is very close to his eyes. And yet there are certain images that he sees repeatedly in these kind of fugue states that are very specific, that are very much more detailed than anything he physically sees.
Yes.
He doesn't recognize those images, but the reader does. And so the reader is brought inside in a way that is very privileged in a
sense. Yes, exactly. That's exactly how it feels. That's the perfect word. It's Lark, nevertheless, who uncovers the secret that we discover is at the heart of the book, and in a sense will make it turn and reveal itself as a narrative. Lark is a teenage girl. I think that you write fabulously about teenagers. I think you write beautifully and honestly about young women in particular. And I think you capture in your writing that rite of passage between childhood and adulthood. In an early section, I read an early section of Lark and Termite in the Granter 100 issue, and it was an amazingly dense, erotic piece of text about Lark meeting up with Solly while the rain beats down outside. To what extent, as you uncovered their relationship, did you know that it had to beat with this kind of sexual pulse? We should maybe explain a bit about the relationship between Lark. You should explain it much better than I. Lark and her neighbors.
Well,
Tucci's.
They're just the boys across the alley, and they're three brothers, and they've been almost like siblings to Lark. And she's had from the very beginning a very sexualized relationship with one of them, Solly. And for both of them, the intensity has partly to do with the fact that his mother left her children, and Lark's mother, of course, left her children. And Solly's father and Noni, the maternal figure in the Larkin and the Termite household, have almost helped each other kind of raise these kids. They have almost a kind of sibling relationship. But again, it has to do with secrecy and with, I think, something that threads through my work, a kind of inheritance of unresolved emotional dilemmas from one generation to another, some of it known and some of it unknown. And that, in fact, sometimes these unresolved psychic maps almost can be acted out in our lives without even conscious knowledge. I mean, we call that, you know, he or she inherited her mother's wild streak, or, you know, he or she inherited this, you know, talent at numbers or whatever. But I think there are times when a generation almost, look at what we're going through right now. We've inherited the unresolved economic dilemma of at least three generations before us. So I think it's very important to sort of connect those dots and to have some realized understanding of how these arcs of history and narrative really work. And I think in a novel or a book, there's a way to see it worked out in a form that we finally see all of it in front of us, whereas we don't see that in real life.
Yes, are there any questions at this point? Yes, in the front here.
Some years ago, on March 8th, 1992 to be precise, we had a very brief conversation, and it went like this. I said, you must be practicing voodoo the way you get into men's minds. And you answered, yeah, I've been studying them real close. I'll never forget that. What I said, of course, I meant to honor your ability to enter not only female but male characters. And I wonder how it feels to take leave of those characters. I had a great problem leaving them at the end of Lark and Termite.
Well, you don't really have to leave them. I would be very upset to think that, they were lost to me. I think once they're inside a novel, a presentation, they are available and immortal, just as they're conceived and presented, and they just continue to kind of enlarge. I think there's a kind of sadness at not being inside the book anymore, as the writer. But there's such a sense of relief that, thank God, it doesn't have to do with me anymore at all. And it's its own thing that is completely apart from me. And in terms of like male and female minds, I really think it's just like wearing a different set of clothes. I think writers have very permeable boundaries, and which can be difficult. But in fact, when I was a very young, like 18-year-old writer, I sent some of my poems to Robert Bly, who's very famous for talking about what men are and what women are. And he wrote back to me and said, "The problem for you is that you write like a man." But I have always found it, maybe because I grew up with two brothers and a father who really did not talk much. My father didn't talk much. But he communicated so much in the way he stood and moved and looked, and in the few phrases that he said were so eloquent. I feel as though one does have to study very closely both, men and women.
You have a terrific kind of second-by-second sense of the calibration of sexual relations, though. There's a terrific scene towards the end of the book where Nick Tucci, the next door neighbor, the father of these boys, sort of lost boys, makes a pass at Lark. Mm-hmm. And the way that happens and the way she deals with that is so finely and beautifully done. Again, this is why I say that no one writes about sex like Jane Ann Phillips, because I think you do give us a kind of fineness in your description of sexual relations that I can't think of knowing in any other work of fiction, actually. But it's partly to do with that kind of glancing subtlety, taking the very small moments and seeing the enormity in them.
Well, I feel as though you need, as a writer, a sort of extreme sensory awareness to the degree that you are leaving the physical world. That is, you express a very physical world so that you can move underneath and beyond physicality. Mm-hmm. And you can only do that into dimensions that are more than physical, from an extremely physical plane, if that makes any sense at all. Mm-hmm. That happens a lot in the Termite sections, because everything is completely and innately sensory, and yet what's being suggested is beyond the physical. And that, in a sense, is what I think happens in all the books.
Yeah.
Something beyond the physical is suggested. And it goes back to the idea of meaning and what our lives actually mean, and the fact that I don't know, sometimes I have this image of sort of the grains, the wheat fields of Kansas or something, with the wind just moving over these grasses, so just moving constantly. And the idea of the nothingness of each of these blades, and the replenishment, the constant replenishment that is so impersonal.
Yes, you describe that exact, you have that metaphor in, you have that image in Motherkind, where you describe it as a kind of ravishing.
Well, I'm glad I used it.
Oh. But would this be a good time for me also to ask you about the Faulkner thing? I mean, I started off by saying Jane Anne's work is like no one else's, and I've been kind of surprised by the number of people that have been saying, oh, it's like To the Lighthouse, and it's obviously The Sound and the Fury is something that's come up because of Termite and Benji, and you have the epigraph taken from that novel. And yet they're so very, very different, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
There would be an example, to my mind, of perhaps the difference between a man taking this subject, or maybe it's a particular kind of man, because Faulkner was a particular kind of man, and your take on it.
Well, I don't know. I think Faulkner was actually very feminine inside what he did, not in his person, but... I think writers typically are very transgender in terms of the way they see things, and I think that he very much set out to make Benji, as he says, an animal. He says Benji is an animal. If Caddy stood in front of him, he wouldn't know her. All he knows is that something's gone. He conceived of Benji as profoundly retarded. I don't see Termite that way at all. I see him as kind of an opposite end of a spectrum, really, from Benji. Benji's senses are not impaired. His thought processes about them are impaired. Termite is like a kind of consciousness moving inside this very limited world has deep fissures. I mean, I love Benji as a character, but I don't see Termite as being like him at all. And I mean, the wonderful thing about the Compsons is that they're representative of the fall and decline and the rot of the South, and the idea that it's built on slave labor and finally wasn't owned by the people who pretended to own that world. And this gets into West Virginia itself, which if anything represents the turning away from the South. I mean, West Virginia was the only state that seceded in order not to support the South, to go with the Union. There's an essay, there's a book of essays called State to State, 50 Writers on 50 States. This sort of was prefigured on the old puzzles of the United States, a sort of map puzzles where each writer tried to represent a state. And I was given the task of trying to represent what West Virginia is. So I went back a little bit into the actual history, which most Americans don't know. People are always saying to me, so you come from Buchanan, is that near, I don't know, some town, is that near some town in Virginia? You know, like they don't understand that West Virginia is a separate state. But the Compsons, as they are symbols of decay, it's almost as though the people in Lark and Termite, they do own their own lives. They're very much working class people. And they meet whatever happens with a kind of resourcefulness, particularly the female characters, whereas the females in Faulkner's world are seen as neurasthenic, or, I mean, Caddy ends up with a Nazi.
Yeah.
You know, that's where her sexuality goes. The women in this book are almost 180 degrees away from Faulkner's sense of the South.
Right. So by using the epigraph in that way, you wanted to encourage us to think about these things and to engage in that sense of difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think Faulkner was talking about folly and the repetition of cycles of civilizations and wars and fallen civilizations in a way that's very important now. Because it's all this, I mean, as Levitt says, it's all one war. It's a war that, you know, just keeps returning. And breaking through that cycle is what human beings sometimes do.
You spoke beautifully about learning to write by reading, and I was wondering which authors were most important to you in that process, and is there anyone writing today that you think we should be aware of that we might not be?
That's always a tough question to answer, so I never answer it. I think we should be reading everything. I mean, the writers who were touchstones for me were outlaws, in a sense, writers who didn't know the rules and so broke all of them. And I think of Faulkner in that way, another failed poet. Bruno Schultz was a very important writer for me. William Maxwell, They Came Like Swallows, is a book I often teach. A Death in the Family, a masterpiece of a book. And again, it's that thing of getting inside the perception, inside the character altogether. The Jilting of Granny Weatherall, when you approach the end lines of that story, there's just this sense of revelation.
Do you still write poetry?
Only in my books.
That's a good answer.
Mm. Well, maybe we should finish up. Do you think I should read the last one?
The last section.
And then everyone have wine and continue to talk.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read a few pages of Termite's first section of the book. Termite. He sees through the blue and it goes away. He sees through the blue and it goes away again. He breathes, blowing just high. The blue moves, but not too much. The blue moves and stays blue and moves. He can see into the sky where there are no shapes. The shapes that move around him are big, colliding and joining and going apart. They're the warm feel of what he hears and smells next to him, of those who hold and move and touch and lift him, saying, "These curls get so tangled, wipe off his hands. Lark, there's Termite." He sings back to keep them away or draw them near. That's all he'll say. He won't tell and tell. Lark bends over him, and her hair falls along his neck and shoulders. Her hair moves and breathes over his back and chest in a dark curtain that falls and falls. Her hair smells of flowers that have dried, like the handful of rose petals he grasped until they were soft and damp. Lark names the flowers, and he says the sounds, but the sounds are not the flowers. The flower is the shape. So close, he sees it, still enough to look, blue like that, long and tall, each flared tongue with its own dark eye. Then the shape moves, and the flower is too close or too far. The shape becomes its colors, but he feels Lark touch it to his face and lips like a weightless velvet scrap. The flower moves and blurs and smears. He looks away to stop it disappearing. Pictures that touch him move and change. They lift and turn, stutter their edges, and blur into one another. Their colors fall apart and are never still long enough for him to see. But the pictures inside him hold still. He sees them without trying. It's how Lark sees everything, everywhere they go. She couldn't walk and run so fast and be so sure through his moving colors, his dark that blurs. But she can't hear what he hears. He listens hard to tell. She never knows what's coming, but he can't say and say. Lark says, feel your soft blue shirt. Want to wear this? She says, hold the crayon. It's green. His grass is green. She says, listen to the radio, even if it's not so loud as you like. She says, eat your toast while it's hot. And she gives him toast, thick and warm and buttery in his hand, with the blue jam on the knife, like the farmer's wife. The knife comes and goes across the plates. The table holds the pouring and crashing and banging while Noni walks hard and fast in and out of the kitchen in her white shoes. Her legs swish every step, and he can feel her stepping room to room to room. No matter where she is, he can hear, and he puts his head on the table to hear the sound alone through the wood, without all the other sounds. But she picks him up, one strong arm around his chest, and the other bent for the seat under him she calls his throne. They move fast, thudding across the floor, out the door onto the ground, where the sound goes hollow and deep. The porch door bangs. All the while, he can hear Elise's car roll its big wheels closer until it turns roaring into the alley, but Noni puts him in his chair. She brushes his hair back with her two broad hands while the car throbs in the narrow tracks of the alley, crushing gravel to rattles and slides and bleeding loud. He calls and calls and he wants to go, but Noni goes. Under the motor's sound, he hears the car take her weight, a sigh before the door slams. The car roars away down the stones onto the smooth pavement and goes until it's gone. There's a shape in the air where the car was. He feels the shape hold still before it begins to end. Slowly the air comes back. The grass begins small sounds. Termite, Lark says. I'll fix the radio. Don't worry. Here's your ribbon, Lark says. She wraps the blue around his wrist. He moves it to his face, just above his eyes, but he doesn't look. Mow the grass, Lark says. Big storm they talk about. He waits. Soon she'll go. She says, don't think you're going to sit out here in the rain with lightning flashing all around you. He holds still, listening. Far down the alley where the gravel meets the street, he hears the orange cat paw forward on its ragged paws. Away down the alley, the ragged orange cat is stepping careful, dragging its belly along the stones under the lilacs. The cat waits then for Lark to go. The cat waits, low and long where no one sees, and the growl in its belly thrums deeper. The cat knows Lark will throw a stick or a handful of gravel that lands like stinging rain. Termite, Lark says. She puts her face close to his, her eyes against his eyes. Lark's brown eyes are stirred like the river when the river is milky with rain. She knows he can see if she's very close, but he doesn't look now. He doesn't try. He doesn't want her to stay. She says, you ring the bell if you want anything. He wants to hear the train. Far off, the train's bell sound is long and wide and dark as the shade under the railroad bridge. The bridge goes over the river, and the trains pour over top. He wants to feel the roar